This is China Law and Policy, and welcome to our podcast. Since January, the situation on the Korean Peninsula has become increasingly tense, with North Korea test-firing missiles, using toxic nerve agents to assassinate Kim Jong-un's half-brother, and announcing that it has the capability for its missiles to reach the west coast of the United States. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has responded to North Korea equally bellicose and frightening, with threats noting that no options are off the table in dealing with North Korea, including possibly preemptive strike. Are we on a collision course for nuclear war? And what role does China play in all of this? To answer those questions and more is noted North Korea expert Jenny Town. Ms. Town is the Assistant Director of the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and is the managing editor and producer of 38 North, a web journal and vital resource on all things North Korea. Thank you for joining us today, Ms. Town. Before we get into the current situation on the Korean Peninsula, I wanted to give our listeners a little bit more background on North Korea. In the Western press, North Korea is often portrayed as a hermit impoverished kingdom run by a dictatorial madman. But is that perception true? Is that how we should view North Korea?
I thank you. It's great to be here. I'm happy to be a part of this podcast. And I think you're asking all the right questions. You know, the problem is the more we treat North Korea as a caricature and we don't take it seriously, the harder the problem becomes in the long run. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a few years ago, my colleague and I, we did write an article that talked about kind of these myths about North Korea. And it's not a hermit kingdom. I think at some point we're more isolated from it than it is from the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. There certainly are restrictions on information access and travel and movement, but there is a lot of contact with the outside world. There's a lot of trade that goes on. There's a lot of business. There's a lot of tourism. There's a lot of NGO workers and diplomats. And so they do have access to the outside world, not the same level that other countries have, but it's not completely isolated. And the idea that Kim Jong-un is a madman is also a dangerous characterization because he's actually very calculating. And the North Korean regime, even when Kim Jong-il was there, people like to make fun of his sort of eccentricities. Mm-hmm. But when it came to state security, the decisions that he made were very rational, sometimes miscalculated. But he's, you know, the ultimate realist. They're a country that perceives to have many enemies and in the process will make decisions on how to protect itself and how to protect the regime.
So in essence, like, we should see their movements as something that is rational if your goal is to protect the current regime.
Yeah, and we should take them seriously for what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Because discounting them is not serving anyone's good.
Yeah, agreed. I guess, like, in that regard, I mean, recently there seems to be a lot of bellicose activity from North Korea. In the middle of February, it test-fired a medium long-range ballistic missile, and then it used, illegal nerve agent to assassinate Kim Jong-un's half-brother at an airport in Malaysia. And then 2 weeks ago, it announced a successful test of a high-thrust rocket engine. But then this week, they had two failed missile attempts. I mean, I guess why are we seeing so much activity that seems warlike in the past, like, month or two? Why now? What's going on?
Well, some of this is a little bit expected. You know, this is a time when the U.S. and ROK are running their joint military exercises in South Korea. Okay. And over the past, you know, especially the last year, this year, the nature of those exercises has expanded. It's become more belligerent, and it's also, included such things as decapitation drills and strategic overflights. And so these kinds of things always spark some kind of response, and a strong response from North Korea, because, they do see it as more than just business as usual, but as a more provocative, more aggressive signaling to North Korea. Mm-hmm. Over the past couple of months, though, I mean, we've really seen an acceleration of testing and at least of demonstration of capabilities over the past year. So at the end of the Obama administration, when it was clear that, you know, the nature of U.S. DPRK relations was not going to change under the Obama administration, we saw a lot of, you know, demonstrations. So, you know, in the past, there might have been missile tests, but they didn't send out pictures of it, for instance, mm-hmm. and they didn't send out pictures of Kim Jong-un celebrating different successes. But I think, you know, now they're clearly trying to prove capacity to the outside world. Okay. And I think, you know, it was actually, though, very quiet at the from elections until inauguration and for a short time after inauguration as well, as they were trying to figure out, you know, what to expect from America and if there was room for changing the nature of our relationship.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just to go back, so when you were talking about the exercises that the U.S. and I guess South Korea are doing, you're saying because those have become stronger and more belligerent, North Korea is taking it more serious? Is that
yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, the thing is the exercises have been going on for, you know, decades.
Right.
And there are times that part of the function of the exercise is also signaling as to how the, you know, the nature of the relationship with North Korea. And so there are times when they're, you know, much more kind of routine standard operations and drills.
Mm-hmm.
But over the past couple of years, they've been adding drills and expanding it.
Okay.
And so and on top of that, the messaging coming out to the media about the drills and to the public about the drills has really emphasized certain things like decapitation strikes and strikes on Pyongyang and things like that. And so it's really become a much more antagonistic venture.
And then I guess just the recent U.S. response to North Korea's actions the past couple of months, especially with the new administration. So Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, when he was visiting South Korea this past month, announced that the U.S. policy of what he called strategic patience has ended. I guess, can you first explain a little bit more what this policy of strategic patience is or was?
Sure. So strategic patience was the Obama policy, mm-hmm. was basically that, you know, it was a supposedly principled approach that, you know, negotiations were only under certain conditions and that in the meantime it was kind of doubling down on pressure on the regime to change its, you know, strategic calculus using such tactics as mostly sanctions and then also trying to bolster defenses in the region, so in South Korea and Japan as well. But it was largely dependent on this whole intimidation, kind of pressure and intimidation factor to try and get North Korea to change its mind about how it wants to move forward.
Mm-hmm. And under strategic patience, I assume that policy, whether or not it was a failure, was put in place to try to limit North Korea's ability to develop its nuclear weaponry. Was it successful with that at all?
Absolutely not.
It
was a complete failure. Like if the goal of strategic patience really was to deter North Korea from developing its weapons program, its WMD programs,
mm-hmm.
it's a complete failure because, you know, they have completely accelerated their programs over the past during the Obama administration. So they've, you know, in 2013, for instance, they restarted their 5-megawatt a 5-megawatt reactor to help produce more plutonium for nuclear weapons. In 2010, you know, they had revealed that they had a uranium enrichment program, and in 2013, we saw that the main facility that they had shown to U.S. Inspectors before is doubled in size. The centrifuge hall has doubled in size. potentially doubling its capacity to create weapons-grade uranium or highly enriched uranium. We've seen, like I said, several demonstrations of tests. Last year alone, we had 2 nuclear tests and over 20 mm-hmm. missile tests. And over the past, during the Obama administration, there's been 4 nuclear tests. Okay. So, if the goal of strategic patience was to deter North Korea from moving forward and making the cost of its nuclear weapons program and WMD programs so untenable that it had to come back to the table, then, of course, it completely failed.
So then they're not going to come back to the table. Let me ask a question.
I wouldn't draw that conclusion mm-hmm. that they're not going to come back to the table. What I'm saying is that policy is not compelling the right response.
Right, right. In terms of all this development, I guess this goes back to the first question and your answer to the first question about not perceiving North Korea as this shut-in country. Where do they get the ability to develop this technology? How do they have the knowledge to develop this technology for nuclear weapons?
So, they've been working on this program for a very long time, for decades. And they've had scientists in country. We know there's been cooperation with other states. They've gotten information from, say, Pakistan and Syria. And Russia in the past. There's definitely plenty of people that they've worked with over the years mm-hmm. To get to a point where some of it's indigenous, some of it's reverse engineering of designs that they've gotten from other countries. Mm-hmm. So they're very resourceful people. Mm-hmm. I would go back to, again, kind of your first question and tying this all together, too. And I think the underlying premise of strategic patience was this idea that Kim Jong-un would never be able to consolidate power under a third generation of the Kim family, and that all we had to do was wait them out, and that eventually the state would collapse, and then we could deal with someone else. Mm-hmm. And that's just simply not the case.
No, it doesn't look that way. So I guess since the Obama administration's policy of strategic patience allowed North Korea to develop its weapon technology and it had all these tests and it's really advanced, just to put it in more perspective, where exactly is North Korea as a nuclear threat? What can it do right now to its neighbors in Asia? And is it really true that they could potentially, in the very near future, have something hit the west coast of the United States?
So we did a series of reports last year that really was a technical assessment of North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. And based on what we know or what we estimate to be their capacity to make fissile material, to produce fissile material for nuclear weapons, we estimate the baseline for their nuclear weapons arsenal to be somewhere between, say, 12 to 15 nuclear weapons. They would have enough material to be able to make at least, 12 to 15 nuclear weapons now. And given the capacity that they have to produce more, their 5-megawatt plutonium reactor, their, uranium enrichment facility, estimates, we did projections as to, within the worst conditions for North Korea, making it most difficult for them, for instance, that even by 2020, they could double the size of their arsenal. By 2020, under a mid-range with a little better conditions and getting their experimental light water reactor partially militarized as well, so they'd have more fissile materials, that they would be able to produce maybe 50 nuclear weapons by 2020. Mm-hmm. And under the best conditions for them, if they have, ample procurement, international procurement, and they have everything running tip-top shape, at the high end, we estimated they would have the potential to make about 100 nuclear weapons by 2020. Okay. So, we see them really now in those ranges and those conditions that are laid out in the report. They're somewhere on that mid to high range track. And then you add in the ballistic missile programs, and you know the fear is always for the how soon are they going to get an ICBM, an intercontinental mm-hmm. ballistic missile. And with the new engines that they tested last year and this year that would be suitable for missiles and not rockets, mm-hmm. Space rockets, that you know we're talking once they have an operational capacity that they would be able actually to hit the east coast of the United States, not just the west coast. But we see that as probably given the designs that we've seen in the prototypes that they've displayed to us, you know, we would suggest, you know, somewhere around, 2020, somewhere in that range. Some estimates have it a little bit earlier. It really just depends. But the reality is, they don't need ICBMs to be a strategic threat because our strategic partners and strategic alliance partners are in Asia. So it's South Korea and Japan. And they definitely have, you know, missiles that can reach South Korea and Japan already. The big question is whether or not they have miniaturization capabilities. A lot of experts do believe they have the capability, even if they haven't been able to demonstrate it. Given the number of partners that they've worked with and the programs that those partners have as well and how long that they've been working on it, we do believe they do have the capability. So it's a huge threat, and it's a growing threat the longer it takes to be able to have a real strategic dialogue with them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I guess in that regard, I mean, when Tillerson was over there this past month, he stated that he was going to leave all options on the table. What exactly do you think he meant by that? And is this harsher stance? I mean, it sounds like it's a harsher stance than strategic patience. Is it good or bad for peace on the Korean Peninsula?
Well, I think it's a little bit out of context. You know, I think the reality is Tillerson is not a seasoned diplomat. And so when he says certain things, he says certain things ways that a seasoned diplomat wouldn't.
Okay.
You know, the reality is right now the government is going through a policy review. And as part of the policy review, of course, they're reviewing all options, including military options, including negotiations. And so, you know, they haven't necessarily come out with their policy yet. So, mm-hmm. you know, part of what he was saying is that, yeah, all options are still on the table. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's exactly what we're going to be doing in the future. The government is expected to sort of be done with their policy review in the next couple of weeks, especially before the visit by Xi Jinping, to be able to have some level of strategic discussion with Xi Jinping. But, you know, it isn't helpful for him to have said it either, again, without sort of those qualifiers, because it does come across more aggressive and more belligerent at a time when tensions are already very high. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this kind of talk is very dangerous, especially if that isn't the direction we end up going, because it's already put the thought out there and it's already sort of antagonizing the situation more than it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's true because I think a lot of in the press already had interpreted that statement as also equating it with preemptive strike.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how serious of a possibility do you think right now in diplomatic circles down in D.C. people are talking about preemptive strike against North Korea?
So I would say people are talking about it, and they're talking about it a lot. But most of the discussion that's happening right now is why it's a really, really bad idea.
Okay.
Because all of the things that could go wrong in the process, you know, because here's the problem is that I think there is some calculation that says, oh, well, if we, you know, it's not even preemptive strikes. It's not like we're watching them load up an ICBM that we know is coming to the U.S. and which would give us the right to defend ourselves from an attack. That's what mm-hmm. preemptive means. What people are talking about now is more preventive strikes or surgical strikes.
Mm-hmm.
So basically preventing them from having the technology by trying to disrupt, you know, their system. So, you know, preventive strikes on, say, missile bases or, you know, missile arsenals, things like that. But I think there's a huge miscalculation if people think that North Korea wouldn't retaliate. So if the U.S. were to do something, you know, North Korea is, you know, almost guaranteed to have some kind of response, and the response might not even be directly on the U.S.
Right.
But again, our allies in the region, it makes it very, it's a very dangerous proposition, one that could have, that could easily escalate into war.
So I guess you had mentioned the Trump administration figuring out a little a more precise North Korea policy before Xi Jinping comes to visit Trump. And I think that's interesting because also in President Trump's tweet a couple weeks ago about the North Korea situation, in addition to saying that they were behaving badly, he also brought up China and stating that China has done little to help. I guess just to start us off, if you could explain a little bit more, what exactly is China's current relationship with North Korea?
China's current relationship with North Korea is not very good either, especially compared to past years. Realistically, they have, you know, under Kim Jong-il, China had a very, you know, had a good understanding of North Korea and had a relationship with Kim Jong-il and could sort of signal to him when he's gone too far. You know, and had a personal relationship with him and knew how he would react to certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Since Kim Jong-un has come to power, you know, Kim Jong-un does not have a relationship with Xi Jinping. He doesn't, hasn't been to Beijing. They don't know what to expect from him. They don't know him. And so, you know, everything that anyone is doing that's trying to kind of send signals to North Korea, we don't exactly know how he will react. You know, we knew how Kim Jong-il would react because Kim Jong-il had been there, you know, for like 20 years, and he had been apprenticed under Kim Il-sung for 16 years before that. Kim Jong-un was only came to the scene a year before his father died.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we never got to know him as the successor before he took over. And now that he's, you know, in power, you know, there's a lot of times where people are like, he's unpredictable. Well, of course he's unpredictable to us because we don't know him and we don't have a relationship with him and we don't know how he's going to react. And too many people assume that he will react like Kim Jong-il did, but he's proven he's not his father.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the question is now is when are people finally going to take the time to accept that notion he's not his father and try and build a relationship with him to try and, you know, get to know him and get how better understand how he's thinking and how he's going to react to things.
I mean, I guess also in that regards with Kim Jong-un taking over leadership and the relationship with China, I mean, it's been mentioned a number of times that he hasn't visited Beijing, but also my understanding, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the execution of his uncle was close to Beijing, and then also the half-brother was protected by Beijing. Is there any, I mean, are any of these things being done to sever even further the relationship with Beijing, or to prove something to Beijing, or do we just not know?
It clearly has had a damaging effect. You know, on an already frustrated Beijing, you know, I think that there's a lot of problems with the way that people think about China's influence on North Korea, and I think they really overestimate that influence.
Okay.
Again, under Kim Jong-il, I think it might have had a little bit more credence just because, you know, again, they had a legacy of working together. But with Kim Jong-un, it's a much different relationship, and it's one of those things where Beijing does not want North Korea to have nuclear weapons either.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to imagine a scenario where they have this secret formula where if they just did certain things, North Korea would fall in line, and that they just choose not to do it. I think this is a lot of how a lot of Americans think about China policy towards North Korea. in the meantime, I think China has done a lot to try and address the issue, but has, you know, limitations on the influence that they have, you know. They say this to us all the time. It's like, you know, it's not like China has a China-North Korea joint army like U.S. and South Korea does. They don't have a mm-hmm. presence in North Korea. They can certainly send messages and send signals. But even the fact that, you know, back in 2015, was that it? In 2016, last year, even when Wu Dawei had gone to Pyongyang to talk to the North Koreans about, you know, like, let's settle things down, the fact that they announced that they were going to do another SLV launch on the day that he landed, I think shows a lot of kind of how Kim Jong-un thinks about Beijing right now. And I think a lot of it is, you know, the relationship has been damaged as Kim Jong-un, I think, is trying to kind of show he can't be pushed around. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, some of this antagonism with China is maybe also somewhat triggered by all this U.S. talk of, like, if we just push China enough, China will take care of this problem. And I think, you know, it puts the Chinese also in a very awkward position. But the Chinese always come back to us as well and say, hey, look, you know, we're doing what we can, but the U.S. should be doing more, too. And the doing more part has to deal with direct, you know, bilateral diplomacy as well. Mm-hmm. And so without that factor, all we're doing is kind of skirting around the issue and just putting more pressure on an already boiling pot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I guess in that regards, I mean, with the situation today and the relationship between China and North Korea now, I mean, how instrumental is China in easing the tensions on the Korean Peninsula?
I think, you know, China definitely plays a big role, but it doesn't play the only role. It's not mm-hmm. something where if we just squeeze China enough that China can, you know, scold North Korea and North Korea is going to come to the table. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other problem is, too, is that even if China, and here's always sort of these clash of tensions, is that, you know, China's national interest is to prevent instability in the region, because instability is good for no one. And the U.S., part of strategic patience is also to try and, you know, they're kind of hoping that North Korea will collapse and that, you know, if we put enough pressure on the situation, we can get the regime to change, which is sort of the path of most resistance and the most danger. So I think there is a certain degree to where China also recognizes that the more pressure it puts by cutting off, you know, implementing sanctions is one thing, but, you know, a lot of people think, well, if China just cuts off North Korea and all trade and all oil and all, you know, goods, that North Korea will just bend over and, you know, will come running back and beg for forgiveness kind of thing. But I think, you know, the problem is that scenario is very unlikely. Even if China does that North Korea is more likely to be more belligerent. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, but then belligerent could be belligerent towards China as well. Mm-hmm. So you never know. We talk about this a lot these days, is, you know, be careful what you wish for. Getting China to cut off North Korea could go one way in a positive way. It could go really bad as well.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, I mean, when Xi Jinping meets with President Trump, what do you think he'll be asking the U.S. to do with North Korea? What do you think his request will be?
I'm almost positive he's going to tell the U.S. that the, you know, negotiations have to be part of any new policy. And even, you know, when China talks about, for instance, if you look at the UN Security Council resolutions, when the U.S. talks about, like, you know, the UN SCR, like 2270 or 1718 or, you know, all the different 2048, all the different resolutions now, they always talk about the sanctions resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the last round, in the 2270 resolutions, for instance, in those negotiations, I think people came away thinking, wow, China really agreed to some tougher measures. And we're kind of impressed that China agreed to these tougher measures, definitely sending signals to Pyongyang that they were unhappy with Pyongyang's behavior. But when the Chinese talk about 2270, they talk about resolution 2270, not the 2270 sanctions. Mm-hmm. And the big difference is that in that resolution, there's also a mandate for negotiations.
Okay.
And so when the Chinese talk about these things, and in response to pressure that, you know, or criticism that they're not doing enough, they always come back with, but you're not fulfilling your end of the portion either.
So basically the 2270 called for not just sanctions, but also going back to the table, and that hasn't happened.
Right.
Okay. So what they're looking for, Beijing, is reverting back to the six-party talks?
Not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But at least getting some level of negotiations going and some level of engagement going, because we're not going to break this cycle of provocation and response until there's some kind of diplomatic offer.
And in terms of getting negotiations going again, I mean, do you think that's even possible given the current regime in North Korea and what's been happening, and also the language that's been being used by the Trump administration? Even if Tillerson misspoke, I mean, do you see that given the tensions between the U.S. and North Korea right now, negotiations a possibility?
I think if it was up to the North Koreans, yes, negotiations are possible. If it's up to the Trump administration, I have increasing skepticism that we're going to get anywhere. And this is going back to your question of, like, is the new, when Tillerson said strategic patience is over, you know, we all look at the things that he talked about after that, and those are really just tenets of strategic patience. So again, without negotiations, you're still just doubling down on the same tactics and hoping for different results. And even if you're, you know, making them harder edged, it's still not a new tactic. And it's still, again, if it's been ineffective now for 8 years, what makes you think just pushing a little harder is going to help? Mm-hmm.
Do you know if right now, I mean, I know the new administration's still getting together their policy team. Do they have anybody in the administration that specializes in North Korea to advise them on some of these issues?
Well, in the State Department, there is a U.S. representative for North Korea policy, Joe Yoon, Ambassador Yoon. But, you know, it's unclear to us who else is working on these issues at this moment, because there still hasn't been an effort to staff up State Department or senior leadership in the DOD. And so there's still a lot of questions, even here in D.C., that we just don't have answers for.
Mm-hmm. I guess, if you had the opportunity to advise the current administration, assuming that its goal is to avoid war on the Korean Peninsula, what would your advice be?
So my advice is been pretty consistent of that, the fact that, you know, yes, you can double down on sanctions and bolster defenses, but without the diplomatic track, the situation is going to get worse. And the longer it takes to try to have talks about talks and see what's even possible anymore, the higher the stakes are going to be in the process, and the more leverage that North Korea builds over time as it continues to grow its strategic arsenal.
Mm-hmm. And I guess
so. It really does. If we really want to make a difference and create a different relationship and one that, you know, serves our national interests, they're going to need to have some kind of diplomatic track and need to be able to shoulder the criticism that's going to come along with that from all the skeptics.
The criticisms within the United States?
Okay. So, you know, there's always the arguments of, like, well, we've tried negotiations before, but they didn't work, or North Korea always cheats. And it's like, Okay, well, just because you tried it before, does that mean you, you know, like, diplomacy is not a one-off and it's not a linear path, and mm-hmm. national security is not a linear path. So, you know, at least if you don't have at least talks to figure out what's even possible within a negotiating framework, you're losing the battle. You're limiting yourself as to what you can do. But
right.
these days, there's so much criticism because we've gotten so far off track that, you know, whoever the next, you know, whichever president decides that the situation's gotten dire enough where we need to suck it up, whether we like it or not, and try some level of diplomacy, it's gonna come with criticism, and they need to be able to deal with that.
Right. And I guess if you're leaving all options on the table, why would you take diplomacy off the table?
Right.
So in terms of, I mean, we talked about China and we talked about the United States. I mean, I guess Japan and South Korea, what are, I mean, I would assume their interest is for more negotiations, or?
So with, not necessarily. You have a pretty hardline government in Japan these days. Mm-hmm. They want to build up more missile defenses. They've even talked about, like, missile interception, and, you know, I think they sort of take the lead from the U.S. as far as that goes. With South Korea, it's different. South Korea, it's hard to tell what they will do next, because it really will be dependent on who the next president is.
Okay.
And their policy could change drastically towards mm-hmm. North Korea, and it could change, and it could be at odds with what the U.S. decides to do as well. And then that's mm-hmm. going to really put pressure on the U.S.-Korea alliance as well.
Okay, well, this was a very interesting interview, and I mean, it doesn't sound like there's any solution anytime soon. But I want to thank you again for spending time talking about China law and policy, and hopefully people will listen to this interview and conflict can be avoided.
I hope so, too. Thanks
okay.
for having me.
Thank you.